Thank you to everyone who supports this show and all the shows that we do at the Major Spoilers Podcast Network. If you're not already, you can become a Major Spoilers patron by signing up at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Thank you so much in advance.
The Major Spoilers Podcast covers news, reviews, and of course, spoilers, and goes into details about the topics discussed. So if you haven't read, listened, or watched the items we talk about, you might want to come back later.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Ashley.
And I'm Steven, and you're listening to the Major Spoilers Podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans.
In this issue, we take to the shadows and follow Luca the Torpedo as he negotiates the life of a contract killer. Plus, there's lots of changes in the world of comics, the return of a doctor, strange things afoot at the Circle K, and much, much more. Plus, the full slate of reviews to help you navigate the waters of pop culture. Brought to you in the mighty Major Spoilers manner. Like the pile of potatoes I've shaped into Devil's Tower, this means something. This is important. So point out Francois Truffaut and watch for Alien Greys, because the Major Spoilers Podcast is on the air.
Welcome to issue 887 of the Major Spoilers Podcast. I've been really thinking if the youngest, we've been watching some older movies, and I've been trying to get him into some of the movies that I have watched from my youth and really loved. He's so on Indiana Jones. He really liked Back to the Future. Really, really liked Back to the Future Part 3. So love Star Wars. But I'm really thinking, would he understand at this age? Because I know I did at this age. I was totally into UFOs. I don't know if Close Encounters of the Third Kind would be a movie that interests him or if it would be super, super boring for him.
It's slow. I mean,
that is a problem, right? It is a problem. But I remember being 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Every year when they would air this on television, I would be glued to the screen to watch Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Ashley, what about you?
I have not seen this thing.
You've never seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind?
Nope.
So my three favorite Steven Spielberg movies.
I haven't seen that or 2001. I haven't seen either of them.
Yeah. So my three favorite Steven Spielberg movies, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Jaws.
Yeah. Close Encounters is good, but it starts out really slow.
It is really, really
slow. And
there's
a lot of stuff in there where I'm just like, did we really need 20 minutes of Roy yelling at his wife and smashing the windows? And I get it.
Those
two, I mean,
it all craziness.
Comes together in the end.
Yeah.
And you do get to the end. I remember when I was a kid, there was the special edition with extended footage at the end of what happened after Richard Dreyfuss steps into the spaceship. But you never see that anymore. So
you do. There's a couple of different cuts. If you buy the collector's edition of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, it's got the three different cuts in it. The director's cut, the theatrical cut, and then the television cut, which includes the 20 minutes of inside the UFO stuff, inside the mothership.
I just watched it on Starz.
Yeah.
And Starz airs the original cut. And it's pretty good. But I feel like the last 20 minutes of that movie are the best part of it. Mm-hmm. The first hour of that movie is just like,
I may try it on just to see. So we'll find out in the future. In the meantime, here's some news. We are hearing word that AT&T has started massive cuts at Warner Brothers, which includes staff positions at DC Comics. Now, according to Variety, quote, at DC Comics editor-in-chief Bob Harris, editors Brian Cunningham and Mark Doyle, senior VP of publishing strategy and support services Hank Canals, VP of marketing Jonah Weiland, and VP of global publishing initiatives and digital strategy Bobby Chase have all exited as part of the restructuring that's going on, unquote. We don't know if there's any confirmation of that as of yet, but that is what Variety is reporting. Missing from the list, of course, is Jim Lee, whose fate has not been announced as of this recording. In total, it appears as if 800 people have been let go from Warner Brothers and DC Comics. Major Spoilers will continue to track this story and share more when we know the facts. The thing that's really shocking about this is that, hey, DC Fandome is coming up like next week. Nothing like having a major event that is supposed to be your San Diego Comic-Con, and then you've announced everybody has been fired. So I think that was a big mistake to do it when they did it. Ashley, what do you think?
It's interesting because people keep asking me about Fandome, and I keep forgetting that it's happening because I fully thought that was like part of their San Diego Comic-Con experience. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. What I want to say is I have seen a lot of people, of various opinions, some of who agree with, some of whom I think are way off base, saying really, crummy things about this. And you can be happy that things are changing. You can be enthused that certain people are leaving. All of that is fine. But like a bunch of people lost their jobs.
Yeah.
And so reveling in that is really, it's not a cute look. I would not recommend people doing that. Instead, we can just like look forward and try to be more positive. What I think, if we want to put our tinfoil hats on, if you look at who is, all right.
Okay, go ahead.
We all got them in place, nicely adjusted. If you look at who is still in place, I think it tells us a lot about what type of content we can see from DC moving forward. Mm-hmm. Ben Abernathy, Mary Javins, who, she's amazing at what she does. You want to look at a great editor. Look at Marie Javin. She is just incredible. She spearheaded so many things that we love. Jim Chadwick. They are the people who are in charge of a lot of the kids' OGNs, mm-hmm. a lot of the digital first initiatives. And Marie Javins is the reason we have the Injustice comics, arguably the best Elseworlds stories we've had in the modern times. Yeah. And I'm surprised that more people haven't sort of gone down that well of sort of trying to predict what the next move is.
Well, I can. Here's one I'm going to predict.
I'm just seeing people saying that there's no single issues anymore. And I'm like, well, they haven't announced
that yet. That's fine. If you want to go to no single issues and go Director 8, I'm totally fine by that. But here's my prediction.
Steven and I are here for it.
Here is my prediction. Say goodbye to DC Universe.
Yeah. Also, a lot of people who were on that. Yeah. Also no longer employed. Yep. So, you know, that's what I think. That's sort of my like big takeaway is like, ooh, actually, if you look at people's job descriptions or what they've been in charge of, there is a lot to be seen by who's left, which mm-hmm. I'm always interested. I'm not a futurist as much as Stephen, but I'm always interested in where things are going.
So apparently, just days after being named the new publisher at IDW, Judd Myers has officially left the company. In a statement, IDW said that IDW has parted ways with Judd Myers and would like to thank everyone for their discretion, which is an interesting phrasing of the On to Better Things discussion. IDW has not responded to any further questions. They have not announced a new publisher for the company. Previously, Myers had been their sales director. He was promoted to publisher on July 22nd, put on administrative leave July 24th, and then left the company last week.
Well, on a happier note, Christopher Eccleston, we remember him. Remember how naked he was in The Leftovers? Well, he's coming back fully clothed as the Doctor of the Doctor Who franchise. Christopher Eccleston is returning to his role as the Ninth Doctor, something I never thought I would live to see. And it may be shocking because many know that Eccleston left the Doctor Who television series at the end of his 2005 series after falling out with the production staff and has declined to return to the role of the Ninth Doctor multiple times over the years. Remember the anniversary? We were so sad. However, Big Finish, who provides us with excellent audio dramas, of which I know because of one Matthew Peterson. Mm-hmm. Big Finish Productions has announced that Eccleston will reprise his roles in a 12-episode audio series coming in 2020. There is a light at the end of this tunnel. Christopher Eccleston said, quote, after 15 years, it will be exciting to revisit the Ninth Doctor's world, bringing back to life a character I love playing, end quote. Doctor Who, The Ninth Doctor Adventures is available for pre-order now, so be like us and pre-order it, with each of the four volumes retailing for $19.99 each, or a bundle of $114.96, which if you're good at math, is not a bad deal.
Not a bad deal at all. Now, we do have to wait till 2021 to get that, but that sounds pretty interesting, Matthew.
It does, and I like the idea of the Big Finish audio stuff in the modern Who setting, because a lot of what we see is the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th Doctors. In fact, I think we have ongoing from 5, 6, and 7, and occasionally the 4th Doctor pops up. There has been some stuff with the 10th Doctor, and I believe that they're working on something with the 12th, but I really like the idea of Eccleston returning for some official stories, partly because, you know, it sucks that he was only the Doctor for a year and 7 minutes, but also because that's a fascinating take on the character. I am mad, however, because I'm already seeing people misreading this and saying, oh my God, there's a huge shakeup at Doctor Who and they fired Jodie Whittaker and they're bringing back Christopher Eccleston. And this proves that women were a bad idea.
OFFS, because I won't say those words on the air.
Not the case. Audio drama is much, much different. In fact, if you want to listen to some Doctor Who, Tom Baker Doctor Who, he actually, there's a series with him hooking up, not hooking up, but interacting with River Song. So you can go listen to those from Big Finish. And speaking of the Big Finish this week, with the announcement that Disney will be releasing Mulan on September 4th, Orion Pictures has shifted the release date of Bill and Ted Face the Music up a week to August 28th to give it a little more time to catch the premium VOD audience. While shifting movie release dates is a common occurrence in the world of physical theaters, now that the releases are going virtual, last-minute shifts can happen a lot easier. So if you have a theater that is open, Bill and Ted will face the Music will show up there as well, but I am ready to shell out some money on August 28th. And that just about wraps it up for the news this week. You can join the conversation about these stories and a whole lot more over at our Discord server. You can join the Major Spoilers Discord server for free, or you can link your Patreon account to Discord and get access to even more features at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Thank you so much, everybody, for your kind responses to how we've been doing the news segment the last couple of weeks. We'd like to hear more. So far, everyone says, let's keep this going. And now with the news out of the way, let us do some reviews. Matthew, what do you got for us coming out of last week from Marvel Comics?
Hey, it's a comic book. That's what Mario would say if he were here. Fantastic Four, number 22, part of the big Empire crossover madness. A couple of times, Stephen and I have talked about Empire, notably on our Dueling Review podcast, but I believe an Empire number one or two came up on this show. And Stephen asked, hey, if you're not following the main story, is it going to kill your book? And so the answer in Fantastic Four, number 22 is not exactly. Written by Dan Slott, art by Paco Medina, this story actually begins with a two-page spread from Empire number 2, where Reed Richards is like, oh no, terrible things are happening. This is not going well. I'm just glad I sent my children home to get away from all of this. Cut back to New York, where Franklin and Valeria Richards, as well as Wolverine and Spider-Man, sorry, I had to say that out loud and listen to how silly it sounded.
Yeah, Wolverine in his blue Franklin Fantastic Four costume. Holy cow.
Yeah, this is the thing, though. They were part of the new Fantastic Four back in 87, and so they are honorary Fantastic Four members. They have triggered a device that has called the new Fantastic Four back to help deal with an invasion from the Priests of Pama, who are actually this sect of, basically, imagine Shaolin monks, only they're alien and they control plants. And so the Priests of Pama are attacking. Spider-Man and Wolverine and Franklin and Val have to fight off the people and try and save a Skrull princess of something Darkseid. Johnny Storm's girlfriend, who is a winged woman from another planet, is also in this. If you haven't been reading Fantastic Four, it'd take a while for me to explain how and why Johnny got a girlfriend who's an alien. But
he's dated
aliens
before, so this is nothing new.
He dated in humans. I mean, this is a girl from another planet. But yes, throughout this story, we have the Priests of Pama trying to find this girl and kill her because she supposedly has access to an Omni-Wave projector, which is a throwback to the original Kree-Skrull War back in 73. I'm thrilled about that, by the way. But throughout this issue, we see a lot of this fighty-fighty, and then all of a sudden, in the middle of the fight, the Hulk and Ghost Rider, the other two members of the missing new Fantastic Four, show up and attack, sort of. And it's the sort of that becomes very important, because the sight of the Hulk and Ghost Rider drives the villains away. And the new Fantastic Four is finally reunited. And Wolverine is like, hey, you just going to stand there or what? And the Hulk is like, yeah, standing here is pretty much all I can do. And then the image inducer goes away. And it's actually Franklin and Val pretending to be the Hulk and Ghost Rider. It's a beautiful scene. I really enjoy it. That's not a spoiler, by the way. There are spoilers that I'm not going to go into, but that's not it. And as the story ends, we realize that in order to keep the Empire, the war in space, from destroying everything, the kid members of the Fantastic Four actually have to go into action with Spider-Man and Wolverine. And they call Reed and say, Dad, it didn't work. The new Fantastic Four didn't show up. And Mr. Fantastic informs them, no, Logan and Spider-Man were summoned to complete a Fantastic Four roster. No one else was summoned because the computer recognizes that two active members of the Fantastic Four are on duty. So Franklin and Val are now the leaders of the Fantastic Four on Earth, and Spider-Man and Wolverine are wearing creepy blue costumes. And it's a really nice moment for, you know, the Richards children. And the issue ends with a, we're going to go, we're going to kick their butts, we're going to save the day, and we're going to look great doing it.
So question, for me, this is really important.
Yes.
Spider-Man wearing a trash bag over his head or a grocery bag over his head, because if he's not, then there's no reason to buy this issue.
No, because that didn't happen in a Fantastic Four story. However, in this issue, he and Wolverine do get black and blue Fantastic Four costumes, and they look pretty stellar. This is the best-looking Fantastic Four variant Spider-Man I've seen, and there are like eight of them.
Who's the artist on this?
Paco Medina.
Okay. He does good work.
And it's, yes, and it's quite good. And honestly, it's a good issue. I like the dialogue. I like the threat. I like the checking of the continuity. The Priests of Pama have been around for literally decades, but we've never seen them in action. They're always name checked. It's like the hoary hosts of Hoggoth, and now they're in our face shooting things, right?
I love that reference. It's one of my all-time favorite Doctor Strange references.
It's a good issue, but the real star is that last page, Blue Wolverine and Spider-Man going into action with the Fantastic Four kids. It's really cool. And honestly, for my money, you cannot beat, and people will tell me I'm stupid and wrong and bad, you can't beat Slott's Fantastic Four. As modern FF takes go, I feel like he's got a handle on things that avoids a lot of the pitfalls. Because ever since somebody said, hey, the Fantastic Four are just elementals, they've kind of been locked into these roles. And it's like team mom and distracted dad and baby man with orange skin and then an idiot who's on fire. And there's so many other things you can do with the characters. And I really like, through Empire, but even throughout this whole arc, how Slott's Fantastic Four interacts differently, but are still clearly the same characters that we've been seeing and still clearly the Lee and Kirby. I'm going to go 3.5 slices of meatloaf, which is good. That is good. That is above average. It's a comic book that I would recommend to you, Fantastic Four number 22. The only complaint that I have that's a major, major thing that I'm like, I hate it, and I just have to get over this, is apparently they've now made it canon that Spider-Man can squint whatever mask he has, and I'm just like, okay.
Yeah.
I love the description of an idiot on fire. That went right to my heart and soul.
An idiot on fire, you know. It happens.
All right. Thank you for that, Matthew. Ashley, let's jump over to what's going on over at HBO Max. Now, I know personally, we just finished up the season finale of Perry Mason, which I thought was very good. Not sure not all of the questions were answered, but I still found it a very good series. But another series that also just wrapped up, I'll Be Gone in the Dark.
Yeah. So I've also been watching The Act from Hulu from 2019 while I've been in the pandemic. So I was talking about this show the other day to Jason Inman, and I referred to this as the murder show, and he goes, which murder show? You're watching so many murder shows. So that's how
maybe
my
Jason should be worried.
Is going. You know, statistically, he's going to be fine. I'm the one who should be worried. But last week, I'll Be Gone in the Dark wrapped up. And I talked, I believe, about the second episode after it began on the podcast. So I thought I would talk about the series finale and wrapping this up. It is based on the book I'll Be Gone in the Dark and the podcast series I'll Be Gone in the Dark by Michelle McNamara, which was her essentially doing most of the legwork to uncover the identity of the prolific serial killer and assaulter we now know as the Golden State Killer. The beginning of this series, I believe I laid some criticisms down at the foot of her husband, Patton Oswalt, because he is very visible. Mm-hmm. He is one of the main hosts of this series, and it did feel weirdly about him, even though if you were writing this as a screenplay, he's very much a tertiary supporting character, right? Like, he's definitely there, but not an active player. And as this series goes along, it morphs from being a little less about the case. And of course, it builds to a triumphant swell because, spoiler alert for like actual history, her work actually worked in line with what the official capacities were up to. And the Golden State Killer was caught. 50 plus people were given closure for horrible things that had happened to them and people they loved. So like, the narrative thrust of the case is solved, which is great. But as this series goes along, you learn more and more about Michelle personally as a figure and the toll that this type of work did on her. And Patton becomes more involved and he speaks much more candidly about it. And I have never had a spouse die, but I have had a family, immediate family member die while I was living in the house. And I appreciated as this went on, we had very much a real world version of the type of loss that was being represented in the true crime story of it. Like, you could not have structured this as a piece of fiction better because the meta and the macro narrative tie together so well. And there is such honesty with her personal struggles and what ultimately led to her untimely death, even as she was able to bring so much closure to not only the victims, but a whole community of sleuths and people that have been affected by this story for decades. And when this started, the book was a bestseller and it was massive and the podcast did really well. And a lot of people have referred to this as being genre defying. And I definitely thought at the beginning that it was a step in the right direction because true crime can be very navel gazy. And you are ultimately making entertainment out of something that is pretty horrible and that inhabits this weird gray area. So I super appreciated that we took the time in telling the story of the case and in telling Michelle's personal story to see the good and the dark. And it really takes the title to a whole new level. And it's going to put a lot of pressure to go and watch Unsolved Mysteries or Trial by Murder or any of the other things that are trying to inhabit this same space because it's just so masterfully done. And this is done as part of HBO Max's documentary imprint. And HBO documentaries, particularly in the world of true crime, because they brought us Paradise Lost, has always been really, really exceptional. And it's a very dark, very upsetting, very personal narrative that's unwound over the course of the series. But I thought the finale was so powerful. And it's so cool when something that you think inhabits a very specific part of the Venn diagram of the things that you're interested in can break into other parts or shed light on this. So if you weren't interested in the beginning, I just can't recommend enough. I'll Be Gone in the Dark, binge the whole series, and but watch it when the lights are on, you know, because it does it does get a bit grim there toward the end.
Yeah. So I have one question because I did watch the first episode.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, and I agree with you with your criticisms about Patton being featured prominently in the first episode, but I could understand where they were coming for that.
Well, but given the circumstances.
Yeah, but so much of it felt like, oh, they're just playing the podcast episodes.
It is a little bit of that because they are using the same audio, right? The woman who recorded Michelle's, I guess, lines, for lack of a better word, is doing that in the podcast. And you can definitely tell that maybe the podcast was made to pitch this. Or the structure of it very heavily informed the way that they laid this out. But as the case gets like closer to being solved and then ultimately going to trial, it breaks off a lot because
that's what I was wondering about.
Yeah. A lot of the women who are given false names and who are referred to by their numbers in the narrative of the book and in the narrative of the podcast, and it's because the TV show was made several years after the fact, have come out with their public identities and they come to tell you their stories. And like that.
Uh-oh, I think we lost Ashley there.
Anyway, I think the last thing I said was like, it was incredible. And then you were like, I can't hear you. And I was like, well, I hope you got most of it.
Yeah, we got most of it. So I wrapped that up there. Okay.
Good enough.
No problem, Ashley. Thank you for that. This week, I am taking a look at Deathstroke, Knights and Dragons, the movie from Warner Brothers Home Animation Entertainment, whatever that they're calling it. This is part of the DC line of animated movies. This is based on, you know, the story of Slade Wilson and his two kids, Jericho and what's her name, Rose, and also the falling out with his wife and all this stuff. Here's the thing about this. Directed by Sung Jin-yan, with writing by J.M. DeMatteis, or DeMatteis, or however you say his last name, apologies. Here's the story of this, because the reason why it's called Deathstroke Knights and Dragons the movie is because originally this was going to be a CW Seed series, and they released the first episode on the CW Seed and then realized, oh, wait a minute, what if we just re-edit this together and just release it as a movie? So only one episode has been released on the CW Seed, and then the rest they saved for this movie. I don't like this.
It's not that
it's a bad story. I mean, it's got a lot of murder, death, and slicey slices and bloods and things, if that's your cup of tea. But it also gets into horrible family dynamics, right? It's like, why weren't you in, you know, obviously Slade is lying to his wife, is cheating on his wife, is having affairs behind her back, is lying about what his real life is as opposed to a businessman. She's also, you know, got a military background, so she throws him out and starts to train her own. The loss of Jericho, but the attack, kidnapping of Jericho, and everything that follows after that. The fact that you've got, you know, stepbrother sisters that are conniving together and using manipulation to show love in all across all four of these characters is just, this is a poster movie for go get therapy, people. Seriously, therapy can do so much to better your lives. And if you'll just take that step and go get some therapy, whether it's marriage counseling or family therapy or one-on-one therapy, it will so much help you deal with all the crap that's going on in this movie. Abuse is love, maybe, is another theme that runs through this thing. It's not good, in my opinion. The animation looks like it should be, and this is before when I was watching this, I was just watching this movie going, why does this look like less than Saturday morning cartoon stuff? Why does this look this bad? And then afterwards, I was doing the research going, why do they keep referring to this Seed series? And I can't find anything on it until I found out it was one episode. And then suddenly it makes sense. This is the CW Seed series just released as a movie. So, of course, it's got cheap animation behind it because it's for the CW streaming service. Plus side, Michael Chiklis is in it as Slade Wilson. So you got that?
He's a good casting choice, actually.
Yeah, no, he's really good. He does a really good job as Slade. But I don't know, man. This has things that just didn't strike with me. Now, is it accurate to comics? Yes, Slade Wilson is Jericho's father. Yes, Slade Wilson is Rose Wilson's father. Yes, at one point, Rose was affiliated with Hive at some point. yes, there is Jackal in this. Yes, there is, you know, his wife, whatever her name is, Alex
Adelaide.
Or something. Adelaide, that's right. And so, I don't know. It's got Bronze Tiger in it, but Bronze Tiger is a villain in this. Gets his arm shot off, or cut off. And then it's also got, what's her face? Cassandra Cain's mom.
Lady Shiva.
Yeah, Lady Shiva is in this as well. Although there is no indication that Slade and Lady Shiva have gotten it on yet. So that is something maybe they're waiting for the sequel, but quite honestly, I don't think there's going to be a sequel to this. If Deathstroke is your cup of tea, if you like him slipping into a third world country's, you know, general's office, threatening to cut off his head and saying, oh, by the way, you're now in charge of the country because the person who hired me to cut off your head was the El Presidente. And by the way, I've cut off his head because I don't like him. If that's your cup of tea, if you like seeing Slade getting shot and cut, and you like to see Bronze Tiger losing his arm, and you like to see Lady Shiva getting stabbed through the chest with a big old sword, if that's your cup of tea, then this is a movie that's probably for you. If you like nice subtle moments, if you like good character development, if you like well-written dialogue, probably want to skip this one.
Oh, ouchy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's just stuff that it's just so flat.
That's
much
such
of its
a
writing.
Bummer, because, you know, we've talked a lot about the animated movies over the years. We've liked a lot of them, mm-hmm. but I've also liked a lot of the CW Seed animated offerings, regardless of the animation quality. Like the Constantine one is great. Ray
yeah,
the Freedom Fighters
really
is great.
Good.
Vixen was great.
Yeah, this one I just didn't care for. Now, everyone's mileage is going to vary. Maybe this is something that you will like, but I walked away from this going, this does not feel like the DC animated universe that we have seen in the past. Now, granted, the new Superman movie that's coming up is going to have a very different art style to it than what, and that's, and of course, this is very different from what we saw in Justice League Apocalypse War, very different from what we've seen in the Constantine animated movies, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This didn't feel like any of that. This felt like a true departure. And I think it's because they had a lesser budget working on this. This is out on digital right now. It comes out, I believe, on the 28th for Blu-ray, if that's what you want to get into. I'm only giving this 2 slices of meatloaf out of 5. Wasn't a big fan. Glad it was only a digital release, so it's not filling up my box. Unfortunately, I'm probably going to get a review copy from Warner Brothers because they keep sending these to me, even though I tell them digital is just fine. So I may be giving one of these copies away in the future. But for me, Deathstroke, Knights and Dragons, the movie, is a pass. So go check it out if you want. Maybe you will convince me that it's good, but I just didn't. I thought it was just, yeah. So there you go. Listeners, you can head over to majorspoilers.com. You can find a whole bunch of other reviews. You can find Empire reviews. You can find Captain America reviews. You can find Batman's reviews. You can find the Cult of Dracula review. You can find so much over at majorspoilers.com.
Dracula.
Yes, Dracula. Speaking of Dracula, you know what Dracula likes? He likes to keep nice and warm and dry. That's how you keep your vampires alive. And what better thing to get for your vampire in your life than some nice clothing or items from isotoner.com or totes.com? Maybe you don't want to get it for the vampire in your life. Maybe you just want to get it for you. Maybe you want to get it for somebody's birthday. Maybe you want to get it for somebody's anniversary that's coming up. Isotoner.com and totes.com has a variety of cool items that you can use as the temperatures start to cool off, as things get a lot more wet into the fall. Here's the best part. You can use the checkout code MAJOR, M-A-J-O-R, at either isotoner.com or totes.com and get 25% off your purchase. Thank you so much for those companies for sponsoring this episode. Okay, let's talk Torpedo.
Yes, let's.
Here's the thing. I really, 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 really think that it is important for us to look at comics from other cultures. This is why we look at manga every once in a while. This is why we try to reach out and look and see what's going on in European comics. And a while ago, I was alerted to the fact that there was going to be a new English translation of Torpedo by Jimmy Palmiotti. And it also featured the art of one Alex Toth or Toth. And I was like, oh, this sounds really interesting. Let's go check it out. And so we did. And it was, and I read this a long time ago. It's a Spanish series, right? So it is an English translation from a Spanish comic. And I was like, okay, let's check this out. But I know it's going to be not to a lot of people's likings. This follows the adventures of Lucio Torpedo, or Torelli, the Torpedo. He is a hitman for hire. And this takes place in the 1930s, 1936 to be specific, the rise of the mob before World War II, but after post-depression, or a little bit after post-depression, starts to slide away. And there's a lot of death. There's a lot of violence. There's a lot of sex. There's a lot of nudity. And there's a lot of violence and nudity with sex. A lot of rape scenes in this.
It is a very rapey comic.
It is a very rapey comic. And so first of all, the first thing that strikes me is that the art is really pretty. Whether it is Alex Toth,
gorgeous. Yeah.
Whether it's Alex Toth or Jordy Burnett. Here's the thing. If you come into this going, ooh, Alex Toth, he only drew the first 2 stories in this volume. And then, because he was collaborating with Enrique Sanchez Abuli, he did not like the direction.
Let's just say we're going to pronounce names wrong.
Yes.
It's not because we're being disrespectful. Just it is what it is. And that name's where we used to say it.
So Toth had a disagreement with the direction that Enrique was taking this story and kindly stepped away and said, I don't think I can support this project, especially after you read the first 2 issues and you're just like, holy crap. He stepped away. And then that's when Jordy Burnett came in and did the art for the rest of this. And this has like 12 issues, I want to say. And it's like 150 pages of comics. It's all black and white. but it is definitely comics from another country.
It is. And weirdly, it feels like comics from another time, but it not does. The time from which it actually comes.
No, this is actually done in what, the 1981 or something like this.
Yeah, 82 was when it started being published, but it feels like something out of the 50s, harkening back to the 30s. And I don't know if that's because, you know, another country and it's Spain and we're getting kind of a Spanish view of the world, or if it's something where it's just meant to be this dark, kind of cynical, almost humorous, but humorous in a really, really disturbing way kind of take on everything. I don't know, but it doesn't feel like a book from the 80s to me. And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Well, no, I can see where you're coming from. I think the thing that is probably the most shocking is that this is also very much a book that you would expect to find in the 80s, because it didn't have the political correctness, I guess would be the proper term here, especially when it's very sexual, very aggressive, very rapey, very violent. Things that you would, you know, you would say in a 1980 movie, for example, or do in a 1980 movie that wouldn't hold up well today. And I think, Ashley, maybe this book doesn't hold up well today.
You know, Here's my hot take on this book. I didn't hate it.
Yes, that's true.
Matthew and I actually had a whole text conversation today about the book. And
the word rapey was in fact used.
It was, I would say, the opening volley. And it is very much that.
Yeah.
But when it's not that, and it's so funny because we've been talking a lot about John Phillips and Ed Brubaker lately, it succeeds in telling the types of story that Brubaker and Phillips really specialize in.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think, and I'm saying this as someone who was not alive in the 80s, and so my only reference as to how people behaved and what was an acceptable jargon at the time is mostly pop culture and other people that I know, but... Mm-hmm. I think if you can look at this as a period piece, I think it's worth taking the time to examine. And culturally, it's very interesting to me to read this book and know that it comes out of Europe, because it feels, yeah, there's reference. They go to France and there's some pretty good French in there. And they talk about Italy when he, spoiler alert, murders his best friend.
Yeah.
But it feels so American in this way. Like, I think there's a lot of, I think this book is very interesting from like a scholarly, like academic perspective, even if there was a point where I was like, this is work to read, like as a woman.
Yeah. Hey, I'll be honest. It was hard work for me to read through this after reading the first two issues. Oh, back in January or whatever it was. I kind of let you guys know. I said, this is going to be really rough. This is a very going to be a disturbing book. But at the same time, I agree with you. This does feel like, and I've read a lot of other hard detective novels from the 50s through modern day that take place during the 1930s, during the height of the mob, right? And a lot of the things that are happening in this book seem very much what I see other authors writing about, right? How they don't take crap off of anybody. They're going to shoot somebody. They're going to have whatever woman they want, regardless of what she thinks and what she wants. That's just the way it is. So if that is what Enrique is doing in this book, just saying, look how horrible this person is, I think he does come across and does that very well. And look how bad the times were back then. Look at his dopey sidekick, etc. I think that captures that feeling very, very well. That being said, there's really no redeeming quality about this character. And that's one of the things that that's one of the things that I look for when I'm looking at bad characters is there something here that makes this character redeemable and makes me want to follow the adventures? And there's not in this book, unfortunately. I mean, it could be. It would be very nice if this character changed as the story progresses. There's a story where he goes in and he kills a priest, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the priest takes one of the church candles and just smashes it into Torpedo's face, into his eye. And I don't know, hot wax and fire seems like that would do some major damage. Yep. And so it would have been nice if future issues would have said, okay, we're going to add a scar around his eye where he was burned.
Or when his cheek gets slashed.
Yeah.
And then we'd never see that again.
Yeah.
And there's no clear continuity that indicates that these stories are actually taking place in the order that we see them either.
That's true. No. This is actually much more like reading a newspaper strip.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Than anything else.
Although you're not going to find this in a new newspaper because there's lots of nudity in here.
Yeah, well, I don't know what kind of newspapers you read, Steve.
British newspapers can have nudity.
There is a lot of nudity, but I will say it's well-proportioned nudity, which for just from like a comics reading standpoint, that is a big step up in this world.
Yeah. So what are some of the things that you and Matthew were talking about?
Oh, mostly just about how rapey it was.
Oh, okay. All right.
And whether, you know, sort of I was like, I don't know if I want to chat about that, you know, because
I mean, you certainly can, because it's a major part of this book. Like there's a fishmonger who is, you know, I think he's Italian. They call him the Cod Man, and he's kind of this schlub. And he's being harassed and he's being threatened and these two other fishmongers, this fishmonger family is going to come and kill him. And so the wife comes to Torpedo and is like, hey, can you help out my family? You know, paisano to paisano kind of thing. And he's like, yes. And the payment will be, I'm going to bang you whether you like it or not. And he has his way with her and he goes and beats up the thugs. And then he comes back, he goes, okay, time for the rest of the payment, and rapes her again. And then at the end, the fishmonger comes up to him to thank him for his help. And he's like, yeah, when your second kid comes out, it's mine. And it's just like, what? You know, it's just very crash in the hash.
Involves the sex worker who Torpedo has mentioned that he's had an affair with. And the minute she's no longer useful to him, he's calling her everything from a hooker to a whore. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. There's, you know, sex workers, real work, all of that. You could have nudity in sex and comics. I don't have issues with any of that, but when it feels hateful and weaponized in that way, like for me, that's the thing that always like draws a line. And we have reviewed comics in the past where it's been difficult subject matter because it is so exploitative or so hateful in a way that something like Sunstone is the exact opposite. Where like, you're not going to get more naked than Sunstone.
No, right. But Sunstone does it in everybody is a willing participant.
Exactly.
Everyone's a willing participant.
Really thoughtful point of view. So like when you see stories presented like that, it can be harder to go back, even knowing that this is a period piece and knowing that besides the fact that it was created in the 80s, it's set in what, the 50s at the latest.
I think most of these all take place in 1936 is when all these stories take place.
Raymond, and it says Chandler that in the clock. Title card. Right.
Yeah. Well, there are some stuff. There technically is some stuff that takes place prior to 1936, like when he's immigrating from Italy to America and he kills a cop and all this stuff. So this is not a redeemable guy.
No, but like that's mostly of our text conversations. We're just kind of like, ooh. You know, like if I could sum it up in a GIF, it would be like somebody pulling out their collar like, ooh.
Oh, yeah. Most definitely. And so that's what is really weird, because as you said, Ashley, we've read Sunstone, which is what, Argentinian? Where is that? Where are they from?
Oh, Stephen, I'm sorry if you're listening and I get it wrong, but I believe he's from Croatia.
Ah, okay.
That
okay.
Sounds right.
So that would be European comic, right?
Oh, yeah.
Then we read something like, and so there's a lot of nudity and sex in that. Then we read Black Sad, which again, it's anthropomorphic animals.
A lot of nudity, though.
A lot of nudity
noir.
And a lot of sex in that one, but not a lot of rapey sex, right?
No.
Then you get to this, which is women are objects, a lot of rape, a lot of nudity. And it's just like there's three different dials that you can turn to when we're looking at sex and comics. And we've had episodes in the past talking about sex and comics. But this one is definitely the most uncomfortable part of this.
Yeah. And honestly, for me, this is a great book to look at.
Yes.
This is an incredible book to just enjoy the storytelling from panel to panel, to look at the moments. But I mean, even the way he treats his little major domo jerk.
Yeah, his little sidekick guy.
Yeah. I'm just like,
well, and you know, so here's the thing. There is some really good writing in this piece. And again, I don't know so much of it is Jimmy Palmiotti's translation of it and what has been changed from the original Spanish into what Palmiotti has done. And that was the other reason why I this caught my eye. It's like, oh, we know Jimmy Palmiotti. We also, you know, want to do European comics. Here's this, here's a potential good comic. There's some really interesting moments where Torpedo really kind of shows off how stupid he is.
Yes.
Right. And some of the words that he uses and some of the phrases that he uses where you're just like, oh yeah, this guy is not very smart. He's good at killing, but he's really bad at everything else. So I like those little moments that are added in there. I think they're added in there for comedic relief, but I also think it reveals a lot about the character of Torpedo and especially how he treats women and his colleagues.
And that may actually be just a teensy bit of racism popping up.
Yes, there is a lot of that in this book, too.
Torpedo is an Italian immigrant, and it's implied a couple of times that English is his second language.
Mm-hmm.
There's an interaction where somebody says something. He's like, what's that? And the guy rephrases it. He still doesn't know the word. He's like, what's that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're playing with it. And, of course, then there's the story that involves the actual black character.
Yeah.
He's like me trying to speak Spanish. I'm like, ooh.
Yeah. I feel like there's a lot of stuff in here. The only thing that I think we've ever read that's even similar to this, and it was not to this degree, was that Parker, the Darwin Cook
Parker
we did a few years ago.
Parker is very much the same way.
Parker is pretty mean.
Yeah, Parker is very much, and I had recommended this to Brian Brushwood's wife. I was like, she was really into some of the, you know, detective books at the time. I was like, this is a really hard character and a really hard take, and I don't like it, but if you want, you might want to check out Darwin Cook's take on Parker. And Parker is right. The same way. He is mean to women. He takes what he wants. He kills what he wants. And really, the Darwin Cook adaptation of the Parker novels is very different from the way the Parker novels are. And the Parker novels are even worse, that are on par with what we see here in Torpedo. And I'm not saying, and I say worse as in these are bad people. Some people are going to say, how can you say Torpedo is great? The Parker novels are great. You know, that's fine. I would agree with you that there is good writing in here. There is fantastic art in here. This is not a character I like. And for me personally, when you have a character that is unlikable, who is someone who is a bad person with no redeemable qualities in it, that's something that turns me off very, very easily, because I'm not, especially in this day and age, I am not someone who is a fan of people propping up villains.
Yeah. And in that very first story that we see, the first toast story we see here really does kind of give us a blueprint for what we're about to see, because we have just this opening moment where first thing we see is him sitting there and his gun. The second thing we see is a topless woman. And then we get to this, you know, the whole story about how all of this comes together. And the way I understand it, actually, that woman pops up again. I believe that she's actually a recurring character.
They all look very much alike. I do not think that they are the same character.
I know that Belle appears more than once, because I've read a couple of other things with this character in it, and the Belle character does pop up again. Not in this volume, but she does recur.
Was I the only one who thought the art felt very Darwin Cook as well?
In a way, not a sharp angle.
Very much influenced by Toth, and Toth and Burnett come from a very similar kind of thing. Yeah, and I would definitely say it's there.
I think most of our listeners know Alex Toth, but just in case you don't, in addition to doing comic book stuff, he also worked for Hanna-Barbera doing Super Friends and Fantastic Four and Space Ghost and C-Lab and Herculoids and Birdman.
I believe it was a Batman cover, but it might be a different one. And someone's going to scream at me on Twitter, but it's a man looking at his hands, and all of his hands are people. All of his fingers. Anyway, I'll Google it, but he's an iconic artist.
Yeah. You know his stuff. If you've seen Space Ghost, you've seen Alex Toth.
Yeah, you don't see Toth doing long runs on much of anything. So when you're like, there's two issues of Toth, I'm like, yeah, that's usually how it goes.
But the weird thing is, he gets credited as being a co-creator of this series, right? Even though he did two issues.
If he created that first issue, I imagine he probably would be.
But
the thing that I really enjoy about this, my only real interactions with Jordy Burnett before this were when Jordy took over the Jonah Hex series in the 2000s.
Yeah.
And another Palmiotti connection there.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about Burnett that I really love is Burnett has that Toth style with the incredible, you know, contrast, the deep blacks, and then the boom, pops of what would be color or pops of light. But he also has what feels like a grittier style, a dirtier style. So even when you see moments where you're just like, yes, Toth would have done something similar here, Burnett's just feel like they're grimier and more appropriate for the character.
Yeah, if you go later on in the book, especially in the story with the priest, where he gets burned and we just see a lot of the shading that goes on in the face, it's like, why does he have so many lines on his face? And that's just the way that Burnett goes in and adds detail to the character, where maybe Toth would not add all that detail and maybe leave it a little bit more plain, kind of the same way that you would see with Darwin Cook. Yeah, same way that you might see with Darwin Cook in this. There were just, this book is very surprising. Matthew had mentioned the one dealing with the rich girl who was in love with a black man and the husband or the father wanting the black man taken care of, and how that story ended, the final page reveal in that, just kind of surprised me for a moment. I was like, oh, I didn't think they would do something like that in a book like this. And that was probably the most surprising and interesting story out of the whole collection for me. That being said,
trying to think if anything actually surprised me besides that.
I mean, and it's nothing, I mean, by today's standards, it would be very tame.
Not everything has to be completely surprising. But...
Right. But there were a lot of little twists like, aha, you thought you were safe with me and I kill you anyway. That kind of stuff. There was a lot of those kind of endings in this book. But this one where you think everyone's dead and then you get to the final page and you're like, oh, nobody's dead. And they're in that kind of a relationship. That was very much a surprise for a book that is supposed to be set in this time period and came out in the 80s. So
feels shockingly progressive, especially given what we see in the rest of the stories here, which is pretty much like hate, violence, beautifully rendered.
Yes.
I wonder if it were a less beautiful book, if I would have enjoyed it less, because even if everyone was pretty bad in it, and I have a hard time when there's no good guys to root for, which is why you'll never convince me to watch Breaking Bad. But it was so beautiful that if nothing else, you could be like, wow, that lady is stunning. The design of this panel is excellent. The lettering is really good.
And that may be the thing that, because I'm sure the question is going to come up at some point. Well, Stephen, why did you pick this book? Because I didn't know anything about it. I knew that we wanted to do something European. Like I said, the translation from Jimmy Palmiotti had just been released. And I was like, yeah, this is something I think we should check out because we need to do a European comic and we're done with Black Sad and we've done enough Asterix and Tintin. Let's try something different. This is definitely something different. And I didn't know what to go into expect, but I can tell you that the cover for this volume is what sold it for me. And the few sample panels that I had seen in other places sold it for me in the fact that this art is beautiful, whether it's by Burnett or whether it's by Toth. This is beautiful art. And yes, you can look at it and just take in the beautiful art. You can read this for some interesting stories and I think a fairly good adaptation in the English translation. But if you're looking for characters that are interesting, if you're looking for characters that are quote unquote good, nobody in these stories are good. Even the people that get killed kind of had it coming because they're dirty, bad people. Dirty as in crooked cops, dirty as in, officials that are corrupt. So there's a lot of that in this book that, you know, you kind of are okay with the people who get killed getting killed. And I don't feel sorry for that. And I'm sorry.
That's just me.
I mean, a lot of people will say, oh, yeah, so you can always love someone like the Punisher because he's killing people. No, you don't have to. He's a bad guy. And so that's how I feel about Torpedo too. It's just like, he's not redeemable. I don't care about this character. I'm never going to read any more of this stuff. What were you saying, Ashley? You agreed?
Yeah, I would say I definitely agree. I also like, oh man, the Punisher is like a whole can of worms and I'm sure we'll get into it someday.
I just don't have the energy to do it right now. These anti-hero villains.
Look, you know what an anti-hero is? An anti-hero is a freaking villain. I cannot abide the phrase anti-hero. It's like, it's one of those things that I'm like immediately screaming as everyone listening could tell. But I would say though, I know we're not quite to the like wrapping up part.
We're pretty close. I mean, you can go ahead and say it.
I would say if people are like genuinely speaking interested in this type of storytelling, or if you are someone who loves the phrase anti-hero, even though like Stephen, I'm not interested in reading more of Torpedo, and I hope we don't do any more for the podcast.
Oh, next week, Torpedo Volume 2. No,
holy smokes. even more work. But I don't think we're saying don't check this out.
No.
But I think it's a very big, like, this was not for us.
Yeah. I think
stamp.
Yeah, I think one of the things you should be aware is, yeah, this isn't for me. This is very, very pretty art and very, very pretty naked people. Very, very pretty violence. But I just don't like the character and I don't like the stories being told. So for me, this is a strong pass. However, if this is something that you want to check out for historical purposes, for art purposes, or maybe you're just like into this, maybe you're just into these kind of tales, that's totally fine. I'm not going to, condemn you or look at you differently because you're like, oh no, this is really good stuff. I love this. Give me more. That's fine. Just not for me. But I do want people to be aware, and maybe that's kind of the whole point of our conversation about this book, is before you pick this up, you need to be aware of what you're getting into, because I don't want somebody to go rush right out and go pick this book up and open it up and go, holy crap, these guys didn't tell me that this was in the book. No, we've told you everything that's in the book. So just be aware of this. So this is not a book I would recommend unless you're really into art, unless you're really into, you know, period type tales and from a historical perspective, because otherwise you're just going to throw this in the trash heap and go be mad because it's like, I can't believe these people recommended this to me. Matthew, what about you?
I would not recommend it. However, I would say that if you're a fan of like the hard-boiled detective fictions, you know, your Raymond Chandlers and your Dashiell Hammetts and your Mike Hammers, this is inspired by that with gorgeous art, but this is also a step further than that. This is not just hard-boiled. This is like parboiled. I feel like the thing that can describe this issue is, or this collection is, my favorite panel is awful. It is beautiful, it's gorgeous, and I hate it because it's literally this full width page shot of a man insulting and punching a naked woman in the face.
I know exactly the panel you're talking about.
Yep, I know what you're talking about too.
And that's the panel where you're just
smacks
like,
her twice. Yeah.
So beautiful. And they're like, yeah, she lost a tooth. Well, you can't win them all. And I'm like, that is so dark. That is so cynical. That is so far beyond what I really want to read in something that I would say still probably comes down to adventure fiction. I mean, crime, adventure, somewhere in that neighborhood. But if it sounds like it's your deal, be aware that it is black. It is bleak. It is cynical. This is just pitch. There is no real morality in play here.
Right. And I think that
you get what you get.
And I think that's the big point, Matthew, where you're trying to say that, oh, if you like your Raymond Chandlers or you like your True Detective type stuff, or your Mike Hammer type stuff, that's kind of really where these two are separated from one another. Because even though you can have a Mike Hammer, or even though you can have, oh, I forget the detective's name from True Detective, the series that I'm reading, the Chicago detective that's in the 1930s, or even if you're trying to read Philip Marlowe type stuff. Right. Yes, Mike Hammer may shoot a woman, right? But it's because she's the bad guy. Also, Mike Hammer has remorse. Philip Marlowe has remorse. The true crime people, yes, the true detective character, while he doesn't have a problem shooting someone, they're also a bad person and he has regrets. Lucio the Torpedo has no regrets.
Yeah.
And I think that, and he has no morals, where the others do have
like
a line where they won't cross.
Only even worse. I mean, he's the point where there's just nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is, I'm very conflicted about this because, like you, Matthew, it's a very pretty book.
It is beautiful,
but it's harsh. It is really harsh.
It is ugly things being drawn in such a beautiful manner that I'm almost impressed with how it never quite masks.
Yeah.
Just the awfulness, the brutality, the darkness, the flat out, unpleasantness and evil that we're seeing in the pages.
So here's the question then. And again, I know this came out in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. Why did this thing go for like, there's like four or five volumes of this.
Mm-hmm.
Why, where is the popularity in this and where is the appeal in this?
Well, it's cinematic as all hell. I mean, it feels like something that had Jimmy Cagney walk out of it, you know, and scream top
well,
of the world.
Well, even the Hays Code would think that this is a little bit too far.
Well, sure. And that's, I think that's kind of the point of it. That's what it is I really loved, you know, a Sam Spade novel, or I really loved seeing these, you know, Angels with Dirty Faces pictures, but they never went far enough for me, says, you know, Abuli. And he says, I really want to see these characters who are conflicted and who do bad things, but don't actually have a heart of gold, he says. In Spanish. And Jordy Burnett says, yeah, I'm totally down with that. I'm going to make it look amazing. So even though it makes you feel dirty, you're going to watch every single panel and go, oh my God, this is amazing.
Do you think there's also just the shock value, Ashley, that is part of the appeal is, oh my God, what kind of horrible thing is happening next? Because this this isn't standalone issues. Don't think that Torpedo was a standalone comic on the stands. This was part of like Creepy Magazine or something. Spanish version of a creepy magazine that this appears.
And there's lots of different. This is not the only comic that's ever, you know, profited from shock value.
Right, right.
And I definitely think that's a fair observation. And you know, if you're a person who's into that, check it out.
Yeah, yeah. Listeners, I want to know what you think. Go ahead and leave a comment over at majorspoilers.com, or send us an email about this, or even better, go check out our Discord. I would like to find out if those of you who have read Torpedo in depth, maybe disagree with us. Maybe you can find out what is good about this. Maybe you can figure out something that is to say, hey, I know you guys don't like it, but here is why I like this stuff. I would really like to hear from people on this, because it seems like most, I would say all of us here just really didn't care for this book overall, even though we do see merits. We do see places where it shines, but just overall, it's not a good product, I guess. I don't know. Let us know. All right. I think Ashley, where can people find more about you?
Oh boy. You can find more about me where I'm not murdering nobody over on Twitter and Instagram at Ashley B. Robinson. Please send me pretty, pretty pictures of pretty, pretty people. And Jupiter Jet and the Forgotten Radio Volume 2 is available for pre-orders. Please do that through your local comic book shop, Amazon, or at jupiterjetcomic.com. And if you are listening to this the week it comes out, I have 3 panels at Mainframe Comic Con this weekend. That's a digital con that anybody in the world can access as long as you understand time zones better than I do, including a spotlight panel on Jupiter Jet. Yay!
And Matthew, where can people find you?
You can find me at Mighty King Cobra on the Twitter. I feel like I need a palate cleanser. And part of my brain is like, I want you to send me pictures of naked women that aren't being beaten, but I know that's wrong. So don't do that. But here's the thing. At Mighty King Cobra, sometimes I do fun stuff and I like list things and all sorts of junk.
All right. That wraps it up for this issue. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for being part of the Major Spoilers experience.
As always, we want to hear your feedback, so make sure you use the comment section at Major Spoilers to share your thoughts and reactions to this Torpedo episode.
Or even better, you can send us an email to podcast@majorspoilers.com.
And don't forget, you can support the show and everything that we do by becoming one of our patrons at patreon.com/majorspoilers.
We will be back next week. We're going to take a look at East of West Volume 1. Why? Because we know that you love comics and we do too. And we will talk with you soon.
Bad Dick's Ray Vision of a Superman. I could save a few bucks and stand around and read through the covers of the comics on the stand. But although every other page would be backwards, I suppose, I could still read the evens and the odds. Well, I don't know. Guess I haven't thought this all the way through. Plus, as soon as the comic book store guy knew, they kicked my butt out on the corner. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Think about a better way. If I was hulking green or gray, I could just bust through that brick wall, take their comic books away. But then the little me would deal with all the tanks and bombs and guns. Have you ever tried to read a series with all that going on? Guess I need to rethink this plan. How would I back and board my comics with such huge hands? Guess I already told ya. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. like a man of iron. Might not be surprised if I'm that I might actually have the heart cold to follow an entire storyline. Would I really even need to read up on all those escapades? I mean, who needs such distractions when your sister's such a babe? But the downside is such a beast. Being shot up in a fun, being the Middle East with a King Santo and soldier. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What a major spoiler. Whoa, 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 whoa. What a major spoiler.
This podcast is copyright 2020 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.